Let's turn to Luke 22 this morning. So I found myself sitting in my office the other day wondering, what's Preston going to think? Preston's a friend of mine from before ministry, actually from my life before Christ. And his politics and ideology 20 years later are very much what mine used to be. His political perspective is the problem with liberals is that they're too conservative. And that used to be me. My college thesis said more or less exactly that. And I'm pretty sure that his views have gotten more and more radical. I'm pretty sure that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is his hero right now, because there was a time, quite honestly, she would have been mine. My views have changed, his not so much. Preston's the same as he's always been, only more so. Hasn't kept us from staying friends. He's someone who can respect people who disagree with him. In fact, he'll sometimes call me up. Can you explain to me the conservative perspective on this? Okay, Patrick, how can you be a libertarian and still believe that? And I almost never persuade him on anything because he's almost never willing to be persuaded. But he wants to understand, and I give him credit for that. He's genuinely curious about how smart, educated people like you and me reach such different conclusions than smart, educated people like him. And for years, it was always a good conversation. Then there was that one day where it wasn't so much. Must be, I don't know, a couple, 3 years ago now, he calls me up. We spend a couple of minutes catching up. And then he says, okay, so I've got a question. How can the Republicans in my state support this particular candidate? I said, well, why wouldn't they? And he said, well he's got this view. And I said, I know. Okay, but have you looked at his voting record? He's got a voting record that's like that. And I said, well, I haven't looked, but that sounds right. If he's elected, he's going to do these things. Probably. He's already done those things. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so what's their reasoning? How can they vote for this guy? And I said, I can't speak for every Republican in your state. I haven't met all of them. But quite honestly, if I lived there, I'd probably vote for the guy. I don't always vote Republican, but if I was living in your state right now, I would. He said, why? I said, because the other candidate is in favor of abortion on demand. Doesn't want any parental notification for any reason. Wants to outlaw counseling on alternatives to abortion. And wants to take ultrasound machines out of crisis pregnancy centers. Long silence on the other end of the phone. And then he says, okay, I don't understand how you can let the fact that you agree on this one specific issue blind you to how completely wrong he is on every other issue. And I said, Preston, we're talking about the only issue that legalizes murder. And after another long pause, he says, yeah, I don't see how you can believe that either. And he hangs up. We still talk from time to time. We're still friends, I think. We're still friendly. But there's no doubt that our relationship has moved into a different category. Part of him, I hope, still believes that I'm a smart, educated guy who happens to have a different ideology than he does. Pretty sure part of him thinks that I'm just a dumb sheep following the flock. Which is why last week, as I went to post some thoughts online about the recent New York state legislation allowing abortion up to the time of birth, I paused and I thought to myself, wow, what's Preston going to think when I post this? And I hesitated. And as I hesitated, after that first thought came another thought, who else am I friends with on Facebook? Who else follows me on social media? And what are they going to think? What are the consequences going to be if I post an article entitled, "We All Know They're Killing Children"? It's a good article, by the way, written by John Piper. And he talks about an opportunity that he had several years ago to speak with an abortion provider. And he went into the conversation armed with what he felt were 10 compelling reasons that the unborn are people. 10 reasons that the unborn are in fact human beings. And he'd hardly begun getting into his, you know, kind of prepped and rehearsed in his mind, and he'd hardly begun getting to his talking points when the doctor interrupted him and said, "I don't need you to convince me. We all know we're killing children." And that's where Pastor John got the title of his article. And he goes on to share how this doctor explained, even though abortion was what it was, and he wasn't denying it, to him it was necessary. To him, abortion on demand was needful because it was in service of what he saw as a greater good. For him, it was a question of social justice. He said abortion is the only way a woman can have the same privilege as a man to walk away from an unwanted pregnancy with no consequences. Yeah, I know, right? Heavy stuff. And Piper's response was even heavier. He lays out more than 10 reasons, not in biblical terms, but in secular terms, in ethical terms, why the unborn are people and why abortion kills children. And nothing but true. But my finger hovered over the return button because I knew posting it would have big implications. Socially, at least for some of my friends, that's the third rail. You don't touch that. And I knew that what would follow would be unfriending and the loss of an opportunity to speak into people's lives. I thought about family members who might cut us off, those who haven't already. I thought about the professional implications. If there ever comes a day where I need to be bivocational again, it's going to be a lot harder to get a gig if somebody Googles my name. And I realized it could even have consequences ministerially because there are those who would accuse me of a hypocrite speaking out against abortion when it's no secret I, before Christ, pressured more than once a girlfriend into having a pharmaceutical abortion. They call it the morning after pill to make it sound more palatable, but it's a pharmaceutical abortion. And so all of this is running through my mind, and I hesitated. In our text this morning, Luke 22, continuing our study in the life of Christ, we're going to encounter someone else who hesitated, someone else who pondered the implications of speaking out. I'm talking, of course, about our friend Peter. You've been waiting for this, right? I talked to somebody last week who said, you know, it's really interesting looking at the different trials in a judicial sense that Jesus went through, the whole Annas and Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. And the person said, you know, I knew that he appeared before Pilate and Herod, but like everything that happens the night before was just sort of blurry to me. And I think that's because when we think about the night before the crucifixion, we think about Peter. His story kind of eclipses everything else that's going on. And so much so that we don't even necessarily think about where Peter was and when he did what he did or why he did what he did. So let's take a look. Luke 22, we're actually rewinding a little bit from where we were last week. We're rewinding before the trial before Caiaphas and probably even before the trial before Annas. In fact, let's make it easy. Let's rewind to where Jesus was arrested. Verse 54, having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house. Again, we've covered this before. We've looked at photographs before of what archaeologists believe was Annas and Caiaphas's house. It's not for sure that they lived together, but I think they probably did. And Peter starts off being brave as they lead Jesus away. At least I think he told himself that he was being brave. As they led Jesus away, all of the other disciples scattered. Matthew 26, 56 tells us that. And we learn in John's gospel that Peter and one other disciple that we believe to be John hung around. But still, verse 54, Peter followed at a distance. He didn't scatter, but he wasn't staying tight either. Matthew tells us Peter wanted to see the end. Been following Jesus for 3 years, he wanted to know how it all would turn out. Verse 55, now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. Who's them? Probably a mix of people. There was a huge crowd that went to arrest Jesus. They couldn't all fit in the high priest's house. Some of them were probably milling about outside. There were probably some servants that were pushed outside when the Sanhedrin came. That was at least 20-some people, could have been as many as 70 people. Hey, we need room. Go stand outside. It's cold outside. Well, you know, burn some charcoal or something. Stay warm. A certain servant girl. We don't know everyone who was there, but we know a few people who were there. One was a certain servant girl, verse 56. Seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, this man was also with him. Here's another one of those troublemakers. But Peter denied him, verse 57, saying, woman, I don't know him. And probably said it about like that. The verb denied there means exactly that, just simple denial. No, I'm sorry, you're mistaken. I don't know. I mean, no big deal, but you're wrong. But watch where this goes. Verse 58, after a little while, another saw him and said, you also are of them. You don't just know him, you follow him. You're one of them. You're one of his disciples. You're a Christ follower. This time Peter gets a little fired up. Still verse 58, Peter said, man, I am not. You're wrong. Stop saying that. Then after about an hour had passed, verse 59, another confidently affirmed, saying, surely this fellow also was with him, for he's a Galilean. He'd picked up on Peter's accent. You know, some people you can tell where they're from as soon as you hear them talk. Oh, you're from Boston. Oh, you're from somewhere in the deep south. Oh, yeah, Patrick, you're from Minnesota there. Yeah, you betcha. And this person says, okay, all of these Jesus people come from Galilee. Jesus did his ministry up in Galilee. Just listen to how he talks. He's from Galilee. This time Peter really gets hot. Verse 60, Peter said, man, I do not know what you are saying. Matthew and Mark give us even more color. Mark most clearly, Mark 14, verse 71, says that Peter began to curse and swear, I do not know this man of whom you speak. But even that's a weak translation. That's the King James editors being polite and quite honestly letting Peter off the hook. What Mark is saying is that Peter swore, he took an oath, I don't know this man, but not just I don't know this man, I don't know this blankety blank blank man. First denial, I don't know him. Second denial, I don't follow him. Third denial, Peter curses him. He curses Jesus. I don't want to offend anyone, but he's basically saying, I don't know this guy, and damn his lousy soul to hell. Worth noting, and we'll talk more about this later, Mark is the only one who gives us that much color, and that's provocative when we remember Mark's gospel was basically dictated by Peter. This is Peter writing about that night after the fact. Gotta respect the fact he doesn't sugarcoat it. Immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And the Lord turned, verse 61, and looked at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. Aha, says the skeptic at this point. Quick rabbit trail, but go with me on this. There are some people who try to make hay out of the fact that there's a rooster here in the gospel because this is taking place in Jerusalem, and everyone knows no roosters were allowed in Jerusalem because they're filthy and they would defile the holy grounds. Sort of like pigeons are a problem in New York, or geese are a problem in a lot of cities. A rooster produces about a pound of manure a week, and so it's historical fact that they kept poultry out of Jerusalem. So it couldn't be a rooster, and this is all made up, says the skeptic. Okay, first question, can you really enforce keeping all roosters out of a city as big as Jerusalem? Second question, wouldn't it be exactly like Jesus to supernaturally arrange a rooster just to emphasize for Peter, yeah, that wasn't a coincidence. That's not just a random bird that happened to be crowing. I arranged for that. And here's another possibility. The Romans of Jesus' day called the hour of 3 a.m. the cock crow. Cock is in rooster. Because 3 a.m. was the changing of the guard at a place like the Antonia Fortress on the northwest corner of the temple. And it would be signaled by a loud trump blast heard throughout the city called the cock crow. So could it be that Jesus was saying by 3 a.m., by the time the trumpet sounds, you'll have denied me three times? I don't think that wars with the text. Either way, verse 60, there's a sudden sound that gets Peter's attention, a sound that Jesus told him to expect. And at the same time Peter hears that sound, his eye catches Jesus being led out of the high priest's house. The door swings open in the courtyard, and Peter and Jesus make eye contact. Jesus looks at him, not angrily, lovingly. That's clear from the verb here. And Peter remembers way back in Luke 22, 34, if you want to scroll back up. While Peter was busy boasting, "Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death," Jesus was quietly shaking his head saying, "Yeah, that's not how it's going to happen." So remembering that and seeing Jesus at the same moment he's hearing the trumpet or the rooster, that all coming together the very moment that deadline passes, is it any wonder, verse 62, that Peter went out and wept bitterly? This isn't a single tear streaming down his cheek. He sobbed convulsively. This is gut-wrenching. What changed? What happened to the guy who was ready to go to prison with Jesus? Because when he said it, he didn't believe those were empty words. He really meant it. When Peter said, "I'm ready to die with you, Jesus," he wasn't just fronting. What happened? That's a stupid question, Patrick. He got scared. Okay, yes, obviously. But what happened before that? What put Peter in a position that fear was able to get the best of him? He stopped following Jesus. How do I know? Well, a few different ways. I know because at the beginning of the evening, back up in verse 32, Jesus spoke to Peter about when you have returned to me. In order to return, you first have to depart, right? And sure enough, when an angel appears to Mary and the other Mary after the resurrection, Mark 16:7, when an angel appears to the women, what does he say? "Go tell the disciples and Peter." At that point, he's in a different category. He's not a Christ follower. And I think Peter began slipping into that category long before the rooster crowed. I don't think Peter stopped following Jesus the moment he denied him in the courtyard. I think he began leaving Jesus when he fell asleep in the garden. And I think he slid further from Jesus when he decided to follow him only at a distance. I think those two choices, falling asleep and following at a distance, set the stage for what happened in the courtyard of the high priest. It was a little less, and then it was a little less, and then in the courtyard it was not at all. Patrick, are you saying Peter loses his salvation? No. And this is important. Salvation doesn't depend on us. It depends on Jesus. And Peter himself testifies to that. 1 Peter 1:5, Peter tells us, we're kept how? By the power of God. Our salvation depends on him. Back in verse 32, Jesus prayed Peter wouldn't fail. If Jesus prayed he wouldn't fail, I'm guessing he didn't fail. Did he falter? Yeah. Stumble? Sure. Fumble? You bet. Did he stop following Jesus? Absolutely. He ceased being a Christ follower for a time. Didn't stop believing. Didn't stop being saved. But here's the thing. If Peter could, in one evening, just in the span of a few hours, stumble from following to sleeping to standing off in the distance to denying, we'd be pretty foolish to think that couldn't happen to us. Maybe it could happen to you, Patrick. It's never going to happen to me. Careful. That's what Peter said just a few hours earlier. Just a few hours before all of this happened. Lord, I'm ready to go with you, both to prison and to death. Pride goeth before the fall much, Peter? Pride goeth before the fall much, church? Because we're both prideful and foolish. We're prideful fools if we don't think we're capable of denying Jesus. I've been a pastor for almost 20 years, and I was on the verge of it just the other day. And if I'm honest, I've done it before. I found myself in conversations that start off about one thing and all of a sudden the subject pivots to gay marriage or stem cell research or abortion, and I've dropped out. I'm not proud of that, but it's true. I've seen opportunities to speak up and I've let them go. I've watched the pitch go by. And every time I had a good reason, spiritual sounding reasons, don't cast pearls before swine. You know, I'm here to love them, not argue with them. Spiritual reasons, practical reasons. They've already made up their minds. They've already heard everything I have to say. That was my reasoning a month or so ago. A pastor that I kind of sort of know sent a prayer request to a whole group of us, hundreds of people on this prayer letter. And it was urgent and it was heart-wrenching. His wife had a horrible medical condition that had defied all kinds of conventional treatment. And he said, we're flying to Seattle, I think it was, to try a clinical trial involving stem cells. And I'm kind of reading, okay, like her stem cells, family stem cells? No, embryonic stem cells. And the thing about embryonic stem cells is an embryo is destroyed, a child is killed to harvest those cells. I thought about shooting him a note saying, okay, I'm praying for your wife, and man, what a situation, but help me understand how you can go there. And I said, well, he's a pastor. He knows all that. And I don't really know him anyway. It's not like I have a standing to speak into his life. So I prayed and deleted the email and moved on with my life. You tell me, was I following Christ when I did that? Because I don't think so. But I don't think that I'm that unusual. I don't think I'm the only one who needs to look in a mirror and ask, am I following Christ when it comes to the difficult issues of our day? If I look at the American church, I think a lot of us are like Peter in the garden. We're sound asleep while a spiritual battle is raging all around us. How do you say that, Patrick? I say that based on the number of conversations I've had just in this past week. Wait, New York passed a what? Legalizing who? When did that happen? How did you find that out? People are asleep. When I talk about embryonic stem cell research, like I did a moment ago, wait, embryos are destroyed in the process? Yes. Which, by the way, would be horrific enough, except that we don't know what they're good for. Adult stem cell research has yielded many, many very promising, very helpful treatments. Stem cells harvested from people who have been born doesn't kill those people. Embryonic stem cell research not only kills, it kills for a maybe. And so many people don't know that. So many Christians don't know that because so many of us are blissfully unaware of what's happening in the world around us. We come to Jesus, we celebrate the new life we have in Christ, and we fall asleep. Wow, I'm saved. That's awesome. I'm going to heaven. Yeah, wake me when the rapture happens. Don't want to miss that. And that would be great if the only reason that we were here was to get saved and meet up with other people who are saved once a week and celebrate how saved we are together. But it's not. If that were the only reason we were here, we wouldn't be here. We have all eternity to rejoice in our salvation. That's what heaven's for. Can we rejoice in our salvation here? Yes, but this life is also supposed to be about helping others find salvation. But to do that, to help people escape from this world, we need to offer people something that's not of this world. And it's harder to do that if people look at us and don't see anything different from the world. We talked about that last week when we were talking about choosing joy. We differentiate ourselves when we behave differently than the world. When we have peace and we find joy even in the midst of storms. But we also differentiate ourselves when we believe differently than the world and are willing to say so. And you've noticed, I'm sure, how hard the world works to deny the difference. You Christians aren't any different. You fight with your spouses just like we do. You divorce at the same rate that we do. Your kids are just as screwed up as ours are. And statistically, that's true if you compare the general population with families claiming to be Christian. Statistically, all of those metrics net out about the same. What's interesting and what doesn't get talked about enough, if you poll families who say that they pray together, read scripture together, go to church together, all of those numbers go down by like 50% down. Divorce, domestic violence, teen suicide, it plummets when the family stays awake. And when the family makes it a priority to stay close to Jesus, not keep them at a distance. See, you don't hear those statistics reported. What you hear again and again is Christians are just like everybody else. More and more you hear, you can be Christian and pro-abortion. Christians are pro-choice like everybody else. And statistically, if you survey the mainline denominations, Lutheran, Episcopal, Presbyterian, Methodist, polls will say that the numbers are overwhelmingly pro-choice. You can call yourself a Christian and be pro-abortion. You can probably even be a believer and be pro-abortion. But can you be a disciple? Can you be a Christ follower? Can you truly be close to Jesus and support killing children in the womb? Not according to the Christ we say we're following. You can call yourself anything you want and believe anything you want. You can call yourself a Christian and believe whatever you want, as long as you keep your distance from Jesus. When we get close to Jesus, that option goes away. Okay, but Patrick, I don't want to be one of those angry people shouting baby killer at scared young women brainwashed by the world. Yeah, I don't either. And I don't think we will if we stay close to Jesus, because I don't think that Jesus would do that. But the fact that people misuse the name of Jesus is not a reason to keep our distance from Jesus. It's a reason that we want to draw all the more close to Jesus so we can know his heart and so that we can be his true voice in the world, saying what he would say, doing what he would do, and doing it how he would do it. How does Jesus do everything he does? With love. Matt Chandler, pastor of Village Church in Texas and president of the Acts 29 movement, said something this week you might have come across. He said, as the church, we must not say of abortion, this is murder, without saying to the pregnant woman, we will serve you. If we're doing the former without the latter, we aren't truly understanding the gospel. We must listen, love, foster, adopt, give money, babysit, donate supplies, mentor young women, and support in whatever ways God has equipped us. Before you argue, he's not saying we can't call abortion murder, because it is. He's saying we shouldn't say that it is unless we're also willing to say to the person confronting an unexpected pregnancy, dealing with the choice that the world is pushing on her, we love you and we're here for you. I think Chandler has an important point, all the more so when we remember in God's eyes what's true religion. Loving orphans and widows, and anyone not willing to extend that definition to single mothers simply doesn't understand the character of Christ. If you've been around Calvary for a while, you know that we partner with Embrace, formerly Wichita Crisis Pregnancy Center, who provides everything that Chandler is talking about, counseling and mentoring and support and practical assistance, Treehouse, another ministry in town that focuses on economically disadvantaged moms. I'd encourage you to pray about ways to get involved with those ministries and others that are doing similar work. And if you know of opportunities in our community that would be a good fit for Calvary, please let me know, because we need to be involved in those ways. If I'm going to stand up here and preach like this, we need to be out there loving like that. But with respect to Matt Chandler and others who have said similar things in recent days, we need to do those things. We need to love in those ways. And we also need to do more. Because we are supposed to be the voice of Christ in this world. We can't let the half-truths and the outright lies tossed around by abortion advocates stand unanswered. We need to speak out. We need to challenge. How do we do that? Not by launching accusations or trading angry slogans. One of the best ways that I've found is to ask questions in love. Questions that hopefully will help people reconsider what they have decided they believe. Like what, Patrick? Well, like, why does New York need a law legalizing third trimester abortions when doctors universally agree that a C-section is safer than a third trimester abortion, safer for mother and child? Keep this one handy when someone says to you, the New York law doesn't make third trimester abortion available on demand. It just decriminalizes it if a doctor decides it's medically necessary. That sounds good. The problem is doctor after doctor after doctor lined up to testify last week. There's no such thing as a medically necessary third trimester abortion. It's a contradiction in terms. Expert after expert wrote last week, it's always safer to deliver the baby by C-section if necessary. So help me understand why we need this law. Speaking of abortion more generally, if it's not a child, if it's just a lump of tissue, as you'll often hear, why do 38 out of 50 states call it a homicide when anyone other than the mother decides to kill that lump of tissue? Along the same lines, why does virtually every medical professional other than an abortion provider consider an unborn child a patient? A high-risk pregnancy specialist named Stephen Calvin says there's an inescapable schizophrenia in aborting a perfectly normal 22-week fetus while at the same hospital at the same time performing intrauterine in the womb surgery on his cousin. Why is a baby born prematurely at 36 weeks human and is human in the 37th and 38th and 39th and 40th week, while another baby due on the exact same day but carried to term spends those same 4 weeks as less than human? What changes in the 7 inches from womb into the world? How can such a short trip change the fundamental nature of something? I move my Bible more than 7 inches, it's still a Bible. I move my pulpit 7 inches, it's still a pulpit. I step forward, I step backward 7 inches, I'm still a person. Well, if they're in the womb, you see, they're still dependent on mom. So is a newborn. And a quadriplegic is dependent on another person. So is someone on a respirator or on dialysis. And under the law, those people are considered vulnerable, even as adults. And they're entitled to more protection under the law. They need mom. That logic doesn't hold. That's an argument for our position. Well, maybe that's true for a third trimester abortion, but you can't say a first trimester embryo is human. What's your definition of human? All organs are present at 8 weeks. Brain is functioning, heart is pumping, liver and kidneys are online. Fingers have fingerprints. At 8 weeks, a child sucks its thumb, responds to sound, draws back from pain. And almost all abortions happen after 8 weeks. But what about the mother's right? Don't mothers have rights? Of course they do. But it's a fundamental principle of our legal system, not to mention common sense. If two rights come in conflict, the higher value must prevail. Do I have a right to swing my arms? Sure. Where does that right stop? At Hector's head. I've got a right to swing my arms, but his right to safety has a higher value than my freedom of motion. Isn't the freedom to live an even higher value? Most of those points are from that John Piper article I was mentioning. It's on my Facebook page. I'll repost it on the church page. But before you start forwarding it to all of your friends, please ask yourself, is that going to start a conversation or end one? Raise your hand if you've ever been persuaded about anything substantive on social media. Yeah. Why do we want to ask these conversations? It's not so we can feel self-righteous. It's not so we can see there's 10 reasons why I'm right and you're wrong. So just sit there in your wrongness and be wrong, you wrong person. We don't want to be right. We want the dialogue. We've got friends who think they know all about what it is to be Christian. That's fine. I don't want to change their mind about Christians. I want to change their mind about Jesus. And I'm not going to get there shouting accusations or hurling slogans or throwing articles back and forth over social media. I want to talk. And I want to talk well. And we're not going to talk well. We're not going to do the conversation great if we're asleep. I'm not going to have an impact on my friend Preston or anyone else if I'm sleepwalking through this life. I need to wake up. I need to read up. And it's not hard. Write down the names of 3 websites. Always Be Ready. You're probably familiar with Charlie Campbell's ministry. He's spoken here several times. Got Questions is another one. And Stand to Reason is a great one, particularly on the kinds of issues we're discussing this morning. Always Be Ready, Got Questions, and Stand to Reason. I don't know that they're the best. They're the ones that I go to most often. You start off there and you'll end up other places and you'll find people who speak in a way that works for you. But if you don't know where to start, start there. And start now, please. Because when the time to have a conversation comes, when the opportunity presents itself, realistically, none of us is going to speak up if we're not already awake, if we're not already paying attention, if we haven't already organized our thoughts. And realistically, none of us is going to seize the moment to ask provocative questions in love and with God's grace try to knock someone off their equilibrium if we're not already close to Jesus. And that's important. When I counsel people coming out of addiction, drugs, gaming, gambling, pornography, doesn't make a difference. I tell them what I tell myself. If you're not already close to Jesus when temptation hits, you're probably not going to pick that moment of temptation to all of a sudden draw close to Jesus. Why did David fall into sin with Bathsheba? He looked at her beauty and he just couldn't control himself. Why was he looking at her? Because he was up on his balcony looking at her sunbathing in the next door neighbor's yard. Why was he on his balcony? Well, he was home and he didn't have anything to do. Why was David home and not doing anything? Because it was the time of year that kings were supposed to be at war, and David had decided to pass. David decided it was okay to be far from God, that obedience was optional, at least in some areas. He didn't stop believing in God, but he decided it was okay to keep some distance from God. You know, have a little personal liberty. That some of God's instructions, you know, were optional. And then when temptation came, David was asleep and standing off at a distance. He was a sitting duck. And my point is, it's the same for you and I. If we're seeking to make a difference in this world, if we're desiring to have an impact, if we're close to Jesus, we can, and we will. If we're far from Jesus, when the door opens for us to be a witness, if we're far from Jesus at that moment, we're going to fall in temptation just like Peter, just like David. And it's not going to be lust of the eyes or lust of the flesh. It's going to be pride of life. It's going to be our fear of man. It's going to be our desire to be liked and stay safe. We're going to be like Peter saying, well, it's warm over here by the fire. If we get comfortable being warmed by the fires of the world, we're not going to all of a sudden decide to trade that comfort for an opportunity to be witnesses and speak truth. We need to learn from Peter. We need to wake up. We need to stay close to Jesus so we can help the world wake up and draw close to Jesus and get to know Jesus and hopefully surrender to Jesus. And as we close, can I say all of this is especially hard, but I'm going to suggest it's especially important to those who have had abortions, and perhaps to those like me who have pressured or bullied someone into having an abortion. I know we're killing children, the abortion doc said. And many here this morning know that we did too. But we don't talk about it. Directly or indirectly, some of us played a part in ending a child's life. But can I say to you in love that that shouldn't be a forbidden subject? What puts that off limits? Guilt? Shame? We have to remember Jesus died so we wouldn't need to carry guilt or shame for anything. What's the world's remedy for guilt and shame? Change the rules. Redefine our terms. So it wasn't a child and it wasn't a life, so it wasn't wrong because it was my right. I got news, it doesn't work. Telling ourselves something bad was actually good doesn't take away shame. It just buries it. It buries it away where it can metastasize and putrefy. And eventually that shame that we think we've locked away finds ways to express itself: depression, anxiety, self-harm, body image issues, eating disorders, problems with intimacy. The list goes on and on. You can find information online, but some of my sisters here this morning don't need to because you've lived it. And you found out the hard way, the only remedy for guilt and shame is Jesus. And he is that remedy. And for the person who's experienced that guilt and then been freed and forgiven by the blood of Jesus, may I say you're in a unique position to talk about the power of his blood and the freedom that's waiting at the cross. Jesus said to Peter back in verse 32, I've prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Peter did that. We saw it in Mark's gospel, how open Peter was, how transparent he was, how willing he was to talk about that night and say, this is who I was, and this is what I did, and this is what Jesus did, and this is who I am now. Forgiven. Beloved. How many of us have benefited from Peter's story? How many of us are closer to Jesus because Peter was willing to be transparent? How many people could benefit from your story? I was listening to Pastor Damien Kyle on the radio yesterday, actually. Somebody asked me recently, isn't radio obsolete? I mean, we've got this Christian radio station, but I mean, in an era where you can just go online and listen to the teacher that you want at the time that you want, teaching the book of the Bible that you want, you know, why would I just take a chance and tune into some guy that I don't know teaching something that I don't know what I'm going to expect? And my answer to that is leave room in your calculus for the sovereignty of God. It's one thing to say this is what I want to hear. But do the experiment. Try turning on True FM and see how often the pastor who just happens to be teaching in the book of the Bible he just happens to be in speaks to something that you just happen to be going through. I'm listening to him yesterday. He's talking about the power of testimony. And he said, you know, some of you guys wish that you had this radical testimony, that you'd come out of Hell's Angels or something. And instead, you're the person, well, I grew up in the church and, you know, my parents were believers. And then there came a day where I decided I needed to make my parents' faith my own faith. And I really began to own it, you know, and I stepped to the left and to the right once in a while. But you know, it was just about deciding that I believed what my parents taught me. You know, some of you have that testimony and you're thinking, man, could I join Hell's Angels for like a month, you know? Just, you know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, just enough to do some really bad stuff. But what he said was amazing and so timely, because he said, we all have a story because we've all received mercy. And we all have someone, maybe someone that we don't even know right now, who needs to hear about exactly the kind of mercy that we've received. And they're waiting. They're waiting for someone to say, that particular kind of mercy is real. And God can love me in my specific situation. Yeah, but my life before Jesus was so... Okay, but have you been forgiven? Maybe you need to try telling someone else about the mercy you found at the cross so you can remember the mercy you found at the cross. Great thing about my gig, preaching the gospel every week forces me to preach it to myself every week. I need that. And there's times when the darkness starts closing in that I remember the more that I have to be forgiven of, the deeper the pit that I needed to be pulled out of, and mine was pretty deep, the greater the story of God's mercy I get to tell. Romans 8:28, all things work together for good for those who love God and are the called according to his purpose. All things work together for good. God can't change the past. He could, but he doesn't. God doesn't change the past, but he can forgive our past, and he does. He can redeem our past, and he does. God can use our past, whatever it was, to affect someone else's present. Maybe even to assure somebody else's future. If we're willing to acknowledge the mercy that we received might be exactly the mercy someone needs. And we're willing to be used of God to tell someone that, to share our story, to be a testimony. Father, thank you for your love. For your mercy, for your forgiveness. And we ask that you'd use us as your vessels to tell the world about your love and your mercy and your forgiveness. I knew before I started talking, and I could see looking at faces that this last hour has stirred some things up. It's unburied some things, unearthed stuff that you haven't talked about, haven't thought about in a long time because you haven't wanted to. And believe me, I get that. But do not let that pull you far from Jesus. Please do not let something from the past invade the present and convince you that you are anything other than beloved of the Father. Precious children. Pure and innocent, because we're washed in his son's blood. We are forgiven, and our sins are forgotten. God chooses to remember them no more. And we wish it was that easy for us, but we can remember the cross as well. And allow that to be bigger, and allow that truth to be more real, and allow it to help us see ourselves the way that God sees us, not dirty, not depraved, not beyond redemption, but in fact quite the opposite, redeemed. And I know that that might take some time, and that might take some conversation. And I'd encourage you, if you're hurting right now, if there's something that you've never opened up and said, God, heal this. Let me be beyond this. Then please start that, because you are beloved of the Father, just as you are. He's called you. He's chosen us. And he is unashamed to claim us. We don't need to be ashamed to run to him.